Everything I said last week, Reb Moshe says, I quoted Reb Moshe, but if he faces the problem, Allah had come of a comma, we face it. But say though, we crept out of it. I'll give you after class when I sort out what I have. I'll give you on your great uncle. You're right. It's the book that came out now is basically a redoing of earlier works that he did. Sam, do me a favor. Close the door. It's cold, despite the heat. Okay. Today is Monday morning, the last day in the year 2013, December 31st, 2013, and 2012. Excuse me, I'm a year ahead of myself, which is all right too. Eizehu chacham haroet hanolad. Yeah, but it's important to keep the date straight, and I want to say Boker Tov to all those in front of me and to the many that are listening across the wide expanse of the earth. Moshe, I was just going to ask where you were yesterday. Are you okay? Okay, good, good. Don't say that because I missed you. Okay. There's no question that the Rabbi Jacob Joseph story is a personal tragedy. And as we saw, I don't believe there's anyone alive today that we know of in the Torah world, direct descendants of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Anyone who grew up in New York, it was one of the key yeshiva. It was yeshiva famous for its warmth, its dedication to its students. After World War II, the yeshiva named in his memory took in many immigrants, chinam en kesef, and raised an entire generation. Most of the kids remained from, if not totally from, but certainly very close. Charles Krautheimer is an example of the author, the writer, is an example of a kid who was taken in by RJJ, and later in life he's paraplegic. I don't know if you realize that he had an accident, but certainly he's devoted his life to helping the Jewish people and Jewish causes. And there are many, many other examples I can tell you, just people I know, the Gluck brothers. I always tell the story, it's this family, Gluck, was literally saved by Wallenberg. They were in a safe house in Budapest, and the last day of the war in Hungary, the Nazis, before they retreated, broke into the safe house, lined up the Jews, and started to kill them, lo aleinu, and they killed the first one. And as they got to the second one, and these people were lined up too, the Russian troops came in and killed every Nazi in sight. And they come to America, two brothers go to RJJ. A third brother who was safe, the family already had a little money, goes to MTA. The fourth brother who was born in America goes to Ramaz. I want to ask you, who do you think wears the black hat today? The brother from Ramaz, exactly. So the name RJJ lives on, but what a tragic story. On the other hand, there's no question that it paved the way for other Rabbanim to come to America, from Gedolei HaRabbanim to come to America. Not only that, and we'll come back to this in a number of months, but by this time Jews are all over America, the Industrial Removal Office, and wherever the Jews went, even if they were Mechallelei Shabbos, they nevertheless built shuls and wanted Rabbanim and brought Rabbanim from Europe or found Rabbanim who had come from Europe. And all over America now, you had East European Rabbanim, among them first-rate Talmidei Chachamim. And I would say RJJ's demise, the funeral, while that was going on, the Agudat HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, was being organized. I don't know, today you laugh at it, because what's the Union of Orthodox Rabbis? But 110 years ago, it was the only show in town, and ultimately a very powerful show, as we will see. But immediately following Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was the Ritbaz. Now, the Ritbaz, Rabbi Yaakov Dov ben Zev Vilevsky, as we said last week, geniuses have a problem living in the normal world. When I learned in Lakewood, so they used an expression in Yiddish, as an anomala, he's normal. And I've explained many times to my students, as a kid, I never understood what this expression meant. A guy is normal? 90% of people are normal. I mean, maybe even 95%. All right, there are crazy people in the world. But you saw in New York what just happened again. A crazy woman pushed a man in front of a subway train, killed him. It's beyond words. She hates Arabs, and she pushes a Hindu in front of a subway train. And but she appears not normal. If you saw today's the New York Times today already, they're sending her for psychiatric evaluation. But all right, that's a miyachein anika. I hope. So what does it mean as an omala? What's the big compliment? But I now, in retrospect, when you live in the Torah world and you learn Torah and study Torah, and you rub shoulders with Gedolei Yisrael, believe me, there's no greater compliment than to say as an omala. Because generally, if you're a genius, you walk upside down. There's always in Bivrit Omrim Gaon Shigaon. The difference between the two is one simple letter, a shin. And you can dash in plenty on why a shin. But here, normal people are not Goinim. Goinim have difficulty leading a normal life. And that's what it does make us in Yiddish as an omala. So you see, the Ritbaz had wanderlust. He was a genius. He published the Yerushalmi. He had tremendous visions of what he could accomplish. And again, I spent perhaps 10, 15 minutes last week that perhaps his greatest accomplishment of all is not the Yerushalmi. Of course, his parish on the Yerushalmi lasted 70 years, 80 years. Today you have so much coming out on the Yerushalmi, including Schottenstein, it dwarfs anything that happened 100 years ago. Perhaps organizing the Sklitzk Yeshiva that later becomes Kletz, that today is Lakewood. When all is said and done, Lakewood is one of the biggest forces in the Torah world. Not all of us live with Lakewood Hashkafa, but you have to admire an institution that has influenced the entire Torah world, including Yeshiva University. I think we're only sitting here in this kollel because of Lakewood, and I've said it many times, and no one has yet to prove me wrong. Those of you who know the inside story, YU was not interested in kollelim. The only kollel you had in Yeshiva University was a kollel of Chesed, which Yitz and I remember. Reb Shmuel Belkin, who was a big Baal Chesed, saw these Europeisha that came over after World War II, some of them from Shanghai, others came over on their own, and Sam, these people what were they going to do in America? They didn't know English, they were greenhorns. And Reb Shmuel Buckland opened the kollel for a number of years. There was a kollel in Yeshiva University for old-timers who were Europeisha till they could adjust to America, till they could wind up, some of them got college degrees, so they found Panasa, but that was a kollel of Chesed. Then the kollel disappeared, and no one thought in terms of a kollel. But by the 1960s, Reb Aaron, Lakewood, Kollelim, and they're branching out, and you already have in Philadelphia, you have in Boston, which the one in Boston, it's interesting, didn't succeed, whatever the reasons were. But the one in Philadelphia becomes a Shem David. Then you have Scranton, and then you have St. Louis, and today, all over America, you'll find offshoots of Lakewood. And that affected YU. And when you look at Rakefet, you're looking at it's a historic fact. I was the last Rosh Yeshiva appointed to the Ritz faculty who did not learn in a kollel. You follow me? I graduated 61. I got smicha. There was no kollel. You were kicked out to the rabbinate. All right. Why you kept its word to me? The next time there'd be an opening for a rebbe, they would appoint me a rebbe in the yeshiva. But I was the last rebbe appointed that did not learn in a kollel. I think by 62, 63, YU already began a kollel. One kollel led to another kollel. Rabbi Lichtenstein was a Rosh kollel. Then Rabbi Heschel Schechter becomes a Rosh kollel. Today already, I understand, uptown you have already, and besides all the kollelim, you have a new kollel in Kutchim. Am I right or wrong? There's a new kollel dedicated to Kudshim. And all that goes back to Reb Aaron Cutler. But if it goes back to Reb Aaron Cutler, it goes back to his father, Reb Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, it goes back to Reb Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, it goes back to the Miyased of the yeshiva, the Ridbaz. Now, getting involved in publishing the Yerushalmi, again, you fellas don't realize that printing today, publishing today, is one of the few things in the world that you can say have become cheaper. Everything else in the world, the New York Times when I was growing up was 2 cents. A subway ride was a nickel. Nope, today the New York Times, what is it, $1.50 a day? A subway ride is $2.25. I think it's going up to $2.50 now. Publishing is 100 times cheaper because it's not setting type by hand. Today everything is computerized. It's beyond my comprehension that they can send a manuscript of 600 pages, just press one key on the computer, sent, print it out on the other side of the ocean, turn it into a computer program, and the only expense in publishing today is basically binding. The binding, if you do a proper binding, costs more than anything else involved in publishing. But at the time of the Ridbaz, the published, the republished Yerushalmi with a commentary like Rashi, take a look at it, it's down in the library, a commentary like Rashi, like Tosfot, this involved what you would say today, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he had to raise money and he started traveling. And he went to Paris, and he went to Frankfurt, and he winds up visiting America. And that's what we spoke about last week. He comes to America in 1900, and he addresses the newly organized, nascent organization. Nascent is a fancy word. You grew up in Israel, right? So nascent, let me explain the word. How do you explain nascent? New, it's new. It's just getting off the floor. Got it? The nascent Ariel University is now in its nascent state. Could you imagine Sam ought to send back his British citizenship? All that bothers Her Majesty's government that Ariel got university status. It's beyond comprehension where we're living today. The world is going under. Hundreds, thousands are killed in Syria weekly. Even Russia is starting to tremble because of Syria. The North Korea is ready to destroy America. Iran is ready to destroy the entire Middle East. And all that bothers Her Majesty's government, Ariel Disciplinary Center has university status. Boy, things must be great in England if that's all they have in their mind. So this new organization, 1898, the OU, and the Ridbaz gets up, Yoni, and he never lives this down. And he gives, I have repeated this to his descendants time after time, because lo aleinu, he has descendants in America that, believe me, the Treifen in Medina, I don't want to go further, but they, plenty of Tafras went their way. And the direct descendants, lo aleinu, yes, direct descendants who are from, but the American branch, it's, you got to look with a candle to find anyone. I play a role. There's one little part of the family, 4 or 5 generations removed, that is Shomer Shabbos today. And I'll take a little bit of the credit. So the Ridbaz says, how did you emigrate to this land, this Treifen Medina? And I explained to you last week, it's a play on the concept of stones. When you kasha, you throw the stones in, the water should overflow. And here, the stones, he's yelling, afile de steine sein treif, the stones are treif. And he describes what goes on in America and the Shabbos. And we explained all this last week. Even if you wanted to be Shomer Shabbos, you couldn't be Shomer Shabbos. They put you in communities where there were so few Jews and everyone worked on Shabbos. And it was a 6-day work week. And he was against English. Now you see, this concept of can we teach Torah in English? While all of you laugh at it when I say the Torah came to an end the day that the Rav started teaching in English, I want to tell you, this was an ongoing battle in the United States for 50, 60 years. Do you teach in English? Don't you teach in English? Can you convey ideas? And this, listen, it's natural. We grew up in a certain climate. The Shanghai crowd came in. We had to learn Yiddish in order to appreciate them. Then you come into the Rav Shir. The Rav was a master of Yiddish. I can call Tova Lichtenstein to you in private conversation. We both agreed that the Rav was a fabulous speaker in English as well. But there was one big difference. In Yiddish, you cried with him and you laughed with him. It was his native language. He was an absolute master. And how can you convey that in English? But could be, it's inevitable. It's like coming in Aliyah. I'll never forget when I first started teaching in Michalan in 71, and this, I had some very brilliant young ladies, postgraduate class. And among them, they were daughters of very world-famous Rashi Yeshiva. And they were very kind to me. They helped me with my Hebrew after class when I struggled for a word. For instance, I'll never forget the word crutches. Whoever used the word kabayim growing up in the United States? Crutches. So I once needed the word. So they told me the word after class. They give me a list of Hebrew words that I should... Kabayim, spelt out, crutches, Rav Goni, multifaceted. I can still remember. I think I have in the office, I have that sheet from 1971, 72 of these wonderful ladies teaching me basic Hebrew. So I hear a girl tell me the Ra'abad. The Ra'abad, I didn't know what she was talking about. I had to stop her. Ma'azeh Ra'abad, lemiat mitkavenet. And believe me, I didn't say it as well as I say it today, lemiat mitkavenet. And she said to me, the Harambam, ha'cholek, ha'mesig al Harambam. Oh, the Ravid, you understand? No, if you grew up, what, you follow me, Moshe? It's hard for you to conceive, but if you grew up all your life, and I learned by Gedolei Yisrael, the Rav, the Ravid, Reb Aaron Kotler, the Ravid, Reb Moshe Feinstein, the Ravid. And here in Israel, some 23-year-old lady is correcting me and telling me that it's not the Ravid, it's the Rabbad. So, I, you know, there is something to be said for this. Again, obviously, when I tell you that I'm convinced that Torah was given in Yiddish, as they convinced me in Lakewood, and I told you that the world came to an end when the Rav switched to English, Eli, take it with a grain of salt. Josh, I hope you know that the Gemara says before you give a shiur, you have to tell jokes. You're familiar with the Gemara? So, Gedolei Yisrael, I have to have a sense of humor. But I want to tell you, when I published my work on the Rav, people complimented me. I know the world in which we live today. I know the art scroll world. So I knew if I'm going to quote the Rav telling a joke, they're going to take it seriously. So if you notice, I put into the book, in brackets, laughter. That the Rav told the joke, the audience knew it was a joke. We went and shall them, don't take it seriously. Okay, now, let me go further. He describes, for instance, the Hebrew schools. And here, he doesn't tell this joke, but I'll tell the joke, but it's exactly his description. They tell the story, this kid goes to Cheder. You know, there were Hadorim. I actually went to Cheder for 1 year. My mother was, you know, I look back now, Zichrono Livracha, she was anxious I should get a Jewish education. So the first year when I started public school, I went to Cheder. In addition to Cheder, they were Melandim that came from the house that taught the kid for an hour and would come, let's say, Monday, Wednesday. You went to Cheder, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Monday, Wednesday, Sunday. So they start teaching this kid, the Rebbe's teaching him how to read Hebrew, fine, and then he's teaching him Kaddish. So the father comes complaining to the Rebbe, what's the matter with you? You're teaching my son Kaddish, when am I going to die? I'm alive. And the Rebbe says, Hatnish Meira, don't be afraid, by the time your son learns to say Kaddish, you'll be over 90 years old. And he says, ultimately in Cheder, what was the ultimate goal? To teach the kid how to say Kaddish. Then he has a tirade, and this is all in his farm, in my work on the Ritbaz, it's all the sources are there. All in his introductions to his Shelet and Shuvit, he was a Lamdan Mufak, so he described, all right, so they're Mechalos Shabbos. But one day they did have off during the week, they had off Sunday. So at least on Sunday, see, he very naively would think, What should they do on Sunday? See, look what happened in Israel. Israel, we got off Friday. All right, you have to adjust to it. I've already forgotten that there's such a thing as a Sunday. When we came in Aliyah, we used the expression, there were two Mondays in the week, because we worked Sunday, which was a shock, and then we worked Monday. So there were two Mondays in the week. But then we went on a five-day week today, which is a great accomplishment. All right. So what happens Friday? There are Friday koilalim all over the country. Heichal Shlomo run sheyurim, Yeshurun run sheyurim. You see, the people have off Friday morning. How men can leave their wives and not work to prepare for Shabbos? Veshechnish, that's a different story. I know I couldn't go to a shiur on Friday. I never taught on Friday, and Bezrat Hashem, I never will teach on Friday. Friday, you know, you have to help. It's Shabbos, it's Shabbos. It's an open Gemara, what they used to do Erev Shabbos, chop the liver, clean the fish, etc., etc. So he describes Sunday, instead of learning, he says they finally get a day off, spend the day in study, spend the day in intellectual pursuit. He describes, I quote, they headed for strolls in the park and the Yiddish theater. And you see, they dressed up in their finest clothes, they walked in the park, it's Sunday. Again, the Yiddish theater is a little alien to you. You don't know the impact the Yiddish theater held on Jews. Out of the Yiddish theater comes Hollywood, by the way. Almost all the original moguls in Hollywood, you're talking Jew after Jew after Jew after Jew. It's even said that when they concluded big business deals behind closed doors, it was all done in Yiddish. Everything was done in Yiddish in Hollywood. And some of the famous actors and actresses were all Jewish. And you don't have to go any further than Lauren Bacall, who's Shimon Peres, who's alive and kicking today, without going into any details, if you know the news in Israel. Shimon Peres, it's his first cousin. Lauren Bacall is Shimon Peres' first cousin. She's a Persky. Her father and Shimon's father were two brothers. It's beyond words. And this was Hollywood. This was the Yiddish theater. It was funny. It was not necessarily anti-religious, but it was very vulgar. It was very, very vulgar. I still remember part of the Yiddish theater in my youth. I remember my mother's father, her parents, my grandparents were big fans of the Yiddish theater. They used to let steam out in the theater. And all right, it was half funny, half vulgarities. You know, vulgarities always get laughs from the audience. I once saw Jackie Mason, I have a video, I heard it, I may have a tape, I can forget already. When I learned in Lakewood, his brothers were around, Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R, if I'm pronouncing it right, those were his brothers. And Jackie Mason was the black sheep, an RJJ boy, we mentioned RJJ, but at least he remained a good Jew, in a sense, a serious Jew, a nationalistic Jew, but very sharp with his mouth. So if you hear him performing before a general audience, you'll hear an off-color word, an off-color joke. He came to Yerushalayim, this is a true story, and he performs, this is when Jackie Mason was, you know, at the height of his career, it has to be in the 1980s, and he performs in Binyanei Ha'umah, and I don't have to tell you, every last American is there, and he breaks into an off-color routine, and there's not one laughter in the audience. And he realizes, Dalif me ata omeid, he apologizes, and he goes into Chazanis, and the place goes crazy with applause. There is Jackie Mason, world-famous comedian, and the chazan par excellence. Of course, Gisid the Yanuk, that a guy grew up, and what a family is. They don't speak to him. I taught members of his family. They wouldn't mention his name. By the way, Zero Mastel is the same story. I taught members of Zero Mastel's family. There was mamish enmity that he's a Mechallel Shabbos from such a family, such a background. So he describes, they finally get off a day. No one opens a sefer, no one goes to a shiur, no one opens a gemara, but They're in the park, strolling, meeting everyone, dressed up like Americans, that probably speaking a bit of English. They speak a little English. And then towards evening, they head to the Yiddish theater. Now, the kashrut, and here he's very insightful, and here he hits the nail on the head. Look, where I was rabbi in Maplewood, New Jersey, no one could fool me. I knew everyone, I knew every store, I knew kashrut, I knew what's going on. Ultimately, I knew every Jew in the community, I certainly knew every frum Jew. That's v'tonchami ani yoshev. You grow up in a certain area. I grew up in the Bronx. Everyone knew each other. Ah, but at the time of the Ritbaz, America's a conglomeration of immigrants. No, what does it mean to be an immigrant? We had a fellow in Bnei Akiva, I don't want to mention his name, he's dead, but a very prominent family. And he always claimed he was Rabbi Doctor. So, Josh, we used to say, where'd you get your doctorate? Oh, he gave us a city in Europe. Where is it? Lost in the Holocaust. No, you lost your smicha, you lost your doctorate. After World War II, all these institutions are wiped off the map. Go and prove it. You see, where there's a conglomeration of immigrants, no one knows each other. And he said, this is what happened in America with kashrut. Guy comes along, I'm a sheikhet. No, where did you get Kabbalah? List the biggest rabbanim in Europe. Where are your papers? Oh, I left them behind in Europe. They got lost in travel. You know, we don't. I know a rabbi, YU graduate, also Lo Aleinu, not alive. He was rabbi in White Castle. By the way, you should know, in his synagogue, it's the only synagogue in the history of America where the president was a former Major League Baseball player. The only synagogue in the history of America, Dafkara, an Orthodox synagogue, where the president was a retired, not didn't have a sterling career, but made the major leagues. He was president of his shul. So he comes in Aliyah, and the boat that has his lift, I don't know what goes on today when you come in Aliyah, but we came by boat. In addition to coming by boat, you sent the lift. The boat that had his lift was in heavy trouble at sea, and the captain gave an order. Four lifts were thrown overboard to lighten the weight of the boat. Everything that he had went overboard. The Balabatim cried, and they raised money for him to buy furniture here, but how do you replace Svarim? How do you replace pictures of your wedding? Think for a minute. How do you, if you have a happy marriage, that's important to you, pictures of your wedding. Perhaps for others it's not that important, I don't know. How do you replace documents? It all went overboard. Today it may be a little bit easier, everything is computerized. But and he quotes an adage, he quotes what would we use an aphorism that the Jews used. Listen to this. And this hits the nail on the head. If you're going to do a movie of the Ritbaz, again, I encourage you, those of you, Daniel, who are going to go into making movies, and it's a big industry in Israel today for religious young men and young women. We have a number of schools producing people capable of doing fabulous movies. The Haredi world as well, you know what's going on, filling the void. Lamalot, lamalot et halal, although I haven't seen it, I don't know. When I go to a movie, I want to see something funny. I don't want to see something sad. I know with the sisters marrying the dying, marrying aunts. When I grew up, I told you, in Salanta, there were a number of children whose mothers were really their aunts. So, all right, I want to go to a movie. I want to see the odd couple, you understand? That's what I want to see. But all right, Mendaf Gain, I promised Malka at a certain point I'll break down and I'll go, I'll buy you when it comes out of DVD, I'll get the DVD. And anyway, when you do a movie, you must quote this. Quote, as, Danny, listen, don't talk. When you talk, it hurts my voice. I know, you can't understand it, but it's a psychological illness I've had for 54 years. As min ruftem Mendel, Megmin Essen fum sein Fendel. As min rufte Mendel, if he's named Mendel, you can eat from his fendel, means a pot. You understand? Very sharp. And that was exactly what went on. And these guys, they could be Machal Shabbos, Ochling the Velet and Treifet, didn't know the first thing about shechting an animal, didn't know the first thing about treibering, but a haste Mendel, minest from sein Fendel. And it's very insightful how he cries about the kashrut. He has another theory, which is interesting, that on the boats coming to America, not every boat had ample kosher food. They did. You should know that most of the boats made an attempt to have a separate kitchen and food, but all right, you're on the boat, something goes wrong, food is putrid. No, some of the people broke down and ate treif. Once you eat treif once, you eat treif twice, you reach America, you're not so makpid anymore. And there was a total breakdown of kashrut. Okay. Now, when it comes already to Tarat Mishpacha, to Yuchasin, here the picture is very sad. Because once again, in America, we developed a new title, a reverend. What was a reverend? Someone who claimed that he was a Talmud Chacham, he knew what he was doing, he could be Masada Kedushin, he could be Masada Gittin, he could do Chlitza, and you have endless examples, and he cites this. We have many cases where it's quite clear that this went on. A person with me Masada Kedushin, the woman didn't get a get. It's America, why do you need a get? She got a civil divorce. Dinner de Malchut de dinner. No, she has children from the second marriage. They're mamzerim tahorim. Many reverends would be Masada Kedushin for a widower, all types of a Megudeshet. They never checked documents. They never waited 90 days. Give me one more second. He even records a case where a man marries his sister-in-law. How would it work? Where a woman marries her brother-in-law, even though she already had children with his brother, with her first husband. And he goes on and on where there is surim, the surim that lead to mamzeret, and the surim that lead to lavim, and one after another, there was no control. It was total hefkeret. Ish hayasha ve'enav ya'aseh. And you know, jumping ahead many, many years, this is why the Rav was willing. It never worked out. But the Rav and Rav Shaul Lieberman worked quite diligently to set up a joint Beis Din of JTS, or the Rabbinical Assembly of JTS, and RCA. And why? Why? And I quote the Rav, at least this is what he's quoted. I can't go into it now, but I'll do it in context when I deal with RCA. And the Rav said, I'm willing to give up my Olam Haba if I can work out a situation where there won't be mamzeret. And this was the whole idea behind the joint Beis Din, that you would require a get, you would require a kosher get, and the JTS Beis Din, the Rabbinical Assembly Beis Din, headed by Professor Boaz Cohn was accepted. His gittin were accepted even by the Agudas HaRabbanim. He was a first-rate Talmud Chacham Yerei Shamayim. He was a scholar of scientific scholarship, of response to literature, etc., etc. But halacha lemaisa, you could absolutely depend upon Boaz Cohn. But at the time of the Ridbaz, it was just total, total hefkerut. And he's just flabbergasted by what he has seen in America. Yes, Josh. 1900. This is all 1900.
So, but I think you said that part of what was leading to this was that people who were coming over were claiming to be Rabbanim or whatever.
Right.
You said that it was, you know, they were
reverends.
Right. The reason that they
Clay Kodesh. No. I just used that as an example. I just shot ahead that in my own lifetime. It's like as if in 1900 I'd ask someone, where's your smicha? Oh, I left it in Europe. So I said, I actually knew cases like that in the Holocaust. And just make me an analogy that it was the same answer. Okay. I don't want to mention it. It's a very prominent family, but he's dead already. Let it be. And we all used to joke around, just like his smicha got lost in the concentration camp, his doctorate got lost. We didn't believe he had smicha, he didn't believe he had a doctorate, but all right, he had to make panas in America, and he had yichus, he became rabbi doctor.
But in the Holocaust, I understand, you know, like people were coming over.
Yeah, okay. How did documents survive?
In the 1900s, if all these real rabbis...
1890s,
1890s. Why were all these, I guess, faux rabbis accepted?
Because you have a kahal of onto 1.5 million Jews already, East European Jews. You know how many clay kodesh they need? It's hefka. Okay. You understand? This is America. America's still hefka until today, I mean, to a certain degree. But compared to what was... Today, look, you have the OU. I always say it's the greatest achievement on the American scene is OU Kashrut. The 1890, 19, we'll see in a minute what happens in Chicago. All right, but do you follow me? It's not, you're trying to bring some sort of organization which you may have in Queens, where you grew up, let's say. Queens, you have a rabbinate, an organized rabbinate, you have an organized heksha, but we're talking 100 plus years ago. Total Hefkeret. And I still remember the shingles, these are little signs outside people's home, Reverend, and it would say, Mesada Kedushin, Mohel, Sheikhet. They could do everything. Now, he goes back to Slutsk, but the wanderlust is within him. Not only that, everyone's starting to talk about Eretz Yisrael. So you have to understand, you don't have to be a formal Mizrahiite to love Eretz Yisrael. If you believe in Torah, Eretz Yisrael is part of Torah. One of the biggest problems that we have when you come in Aliyah, and I've often told this to my Talmidim, and you go back the first time to America, you want to yell, you want to shout, what are you crazy, you're from Jews, what are you sitting in Chicago, what are you sitting in Teaneck, what are you sitting in Toronto, what are you sitting in Lawrence, what are you sitting in Kew Gardens Hills, what are you sitting in Los Angeles, Eretz Yisrael needs you, Eretz Yisrael, we daven Eretz Yisrael, v'nei Yerushalayim, yed HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'tachan v'nei Mitzvah, v'tachan v'rachamim, all of our, don't you read Pashat Lech Lecha, or did you rip it out of your Torah? And you want to yell and shout. And I always caution people when they go back, if you say one word like that, you're going to get nowhere. Because, you know, everyone lives in their own world. They've made their compromises. They've made their peace with their situation. And they'll give you 101 names of great rabbis that live in Baltimore and live in the five towns. And then, you're going to get nowhere. Ultimately, we do get an aliyah from the States, and Rakefet always says we get trumat maishret, we get the finest people come in aliyah. But you have to be worthy. It's we all live in two worlds, and the ger v'toshav within us is in constant battle. The Ridbaz was a tremendous Zionist, not a formal Zionist, but he starts dreaming, I'm going to settle in Eretz Yisrael. How can he settle in Eretz Yisrael? He owes hundreds of thousands of zlotys on publishing the Yerushalmi. He still owes money. But he comes back to America, 1903. He already is Hebraized. He no longer uses the name Volovsky, but uses the acronym Harav Ridbaz. Ridbaz, Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev, and the last name Volovsky is basically forgotten, comes back, the Ridbaz, and Chicago offers him the rabbinate. The idea, Chicago, which is a very vibrant Jewish community with endless East Europeans, you will be our chief rabbi. And they even promise him a pension later in life. that he'll be able to settle in Eretz Yisrael in dignity. So in 1903, the Ritvaz goes to Chicago, $2,500 a year, which is a very good salary, as you know by now, a fortune of money, dignity. The Agudas HaRabbanim in 1903 at their second convention votes him the title Zakein Rabbanei Atzot HaBrit. He's not only the chief rabbi of Chicago, but he's the elder rabbi of the United States. They are so proud, the Ritvaz, the Slutsky Rav, the founder of this major yeshiva. He is now in the United States. He is now in Chicago. Everyone, all the Rabbanim will be subservient to him. He is the Zakein HaRabbanim. And gentlemen, here you have the same tragedy of the United States. It is intense. It is frightening. I'm going to give you material for the movie. It is going to be a movie that will be a blockbuster as far as attendance and interest. What is his dream? And once again, we come back to the same dream Rabbi Yaakov Yosef had. My dear students, there is nothing more important to the Jewish people than the study of Torah. If we do not study Torah, we do not have Jews tomorrow. One of my grandsons, who likes to dig me, I would say, gave me a whole argument a few weeks ago. I quote him, "Saba, with your mind, you should have gone into research. You would have solved the problem of cancer." I told him, "What? That's fabulous. But what I did was more important. I created Jews for tomorrow." "All right." He listened. I quote the Rav, "There's no one more important in life than a Malamed. He is more important than the high priest, than the king, than the warrior. Nobody more important than a Malamed." And the reason is simple. Torah is a way of life, but it's not a way of life you can just emulate. You have to, lo am eretz chassid, lo bur yirei chet. Allah had come of a come in a world where all the children go to high school, later go to college. Today we're living in a world where everyone goes to postgraduate school. If you just have a bachelor's, you're viewed as a kvesa technician, a laborer. What's life without a master's? Today, how many women have doctorates even in Lakewood? Women can get doctorates. They support their husbands, panasa. How many women are doctors, medical doctors? Who saw female medical doctors when I was growing up? Today, some of my finest students from Michlalar, Israeli girls and Anglo girls, are all in the medical profession. How many dentists here in Israel? I see a new American Ola advertises she's a dentist in a friendly environment, if I read the ad correctly. Okay, he wants to bring a yeshiva, wants to bring some of his Talmidim from Slutsk to Chicago. But then again, you have the problem. In order to bring Talmidim, it has to be proper kashrut. We have to eat. None of us can survive without eating, with all due respects. You don't drink water, you're going to go under. You don't eat, you have to eat. No, in order to eat, you need kashrut. And particularly at that era, what was considered healthy? Meat, meat, meat. Today it's amazing. The less red meat you eat, the healthier you are. I grew up in a world, you have to have chopped liver. Without chopped liver, you know, who knew about cholesterol? Who knew about the other studies with red meat that are so negative? No, you have to have meat, you have to have shaykhim, you have to have kashrut. So the Ritvaz attempts to organize kashrut in Chicago. Now, you have to understand what Chicago was. The meat in America comes from the Midwest. Chicago was a tremendous hub for cattle slaughter and transportation all over the United States. Four tremendous slaughterhouses had kosher divisions. Now you have to understand, there is no such thing as a kosher slaughterhouse. That concept doesn't exist. It doesn't exist because very simply, 25% of the cattle you will slaughter will be treif. Right or wrong, any of you who've been in a slaughterhouse, any of you who grew up, if your fathers were sheikhim, rabbonim makshirim, 22, 23%. The Rav used to, one time, the Rav got hysterical in class and he used the word about glat kosher, glat treif. So we calmed the Rav down after class. In class, you didn't calm him down. But after class, the fellows who were close to him, Rebbe, what do you mean? What's maintenance glat? So he explained that a slaughterhouse has to have a certain percentage of treif. And he said that he knows this glat kosher slaughterhouse where the percentage is way below what it should be. And he knows because he was giving hechsher on slaughterhouses in the Boston area. So the Rav used to glatta, you have to have. There's no such thing as a kosher slaughter. But what would happen is, and this still goes on until today, in major slaughterhouses, they accommodate an area for kosher slaughtering. And it works well for both, because you can kosher slaughter, and what's treif, you immediately move to the rest of the slaughterhouse. They'll buy the meat from you and use it for a tafis. It was kosher slaughtered. It's slaughtered already. The meat is fresh. The meat is good. Non-Jews are not concerned with tafis. So that's why in a kosher slaughterhouse, it's wonderful to be part of a big operation. Fine. Now, this, of course, entails very close supervision. Don't, Ellie, what are you troubled? You look like... Go ahead, ask.
What did the Rabbi eat when he was there before?
What he ate privately? I don't know. I can't answer that. But he got along without meat. He was a vegetarian. You know, Rabbi Yosef Weiss used to swear to me the story is true. He used to tell me, Rabbi Yosef Weiss, my only Rebbe who's still alive, should live and be well. He's in his 90s. So Rabbi Yosef used to tell me that there was a man on the east side who wouldn't eat anything. Poultry, cattle, he didn't trust any shechita in America. So what did he live on? The doctor said, you have to have protein, you have to have peanuts. He lived on peanuts. And then 10 years later, he found out the peanuts were roasted in chaza fat, in lard. So you see, today, no one uses lard for health reasons, and it's cheaper, regular vegetable. But I remember yet when there was no kosher pretzel, because all the pretzels were in lard. Now we've come full cycle. There's no kosher pretzel anymore. That's parva. I don't know what got into the OU. I don't know the full details. But I was flabbergasted in New York. Every product I picked up, O-U-D. O-U-D. O-U-D tells me I can't eat it with fleishiks. What can I tell you? I hear what you're saying, but the product never read O-U-D. It read O-U.
Right, no, that's the point. They switched everything that used to be D-E. Now they just
this, D-E. All I know is I never yet saw a pretzel with D-E. And now pretzels galore O-U-D. Believe me, I'm the happiest guy alive. I have no problem. I barely eat fleishiks. But nevertheless, yes. But what a change, what a change, what a sea change. We've come full cycle. Anyway, now, what was going on in Chicago with Kashrut? Okay, one of the greatest rabbanim to set foot in America in the 19th century was Rabbi Avraham Yaakov Gershom Lisa. He was the Rav HaMakshir in Chicago. He corresponded with the Netziv. The famous tshuva of the Netziv that I always quote, Meshev David Zion, with that wealthy guy who made a lot of money in America, and he wanted to show everybody he's a big shot as an Americana. So he went and gave an Aron HaKodesh to the shul. But he made it tonight that they have to read the Torah on a Sunday morning when everyone is home from work and he has to get an aliyah, that all the men and the women and the kinder, the children will see what a big shot he is. He made it in America. Lou, can you read a Torah Sunday morning? Not Rosh Chodesh, not anything, just a plain Sunday morning? And the poor Netziv, and the poor Rav Lisa, he made it conditional, his contribution, upon being the big shot in front of everybody. And he corresponds with the Netziv. Can you read the Torah on a Sunday morning when there's no chovah, or are they brachot levatala? And that's Rabbi Lisa. He moves to Cincinnati. When he moves to Cincinnati in 1898, he gives up the Hechsherim in Chicago. Reb Avraham Yaakov Gershon Lisa. It's a very famous name in the history of the rabbinate in America. Of course, he goes on to be many, many years in Cincinnati, and he's a widely respected rav. When he leaves Chicago, there's another Litvisher Rav there, Reb Tzvi Shimon Album, A-L-B-U-M. And he takes over the Hashgacha. Now, I want to tell you who this Rabbi Album was. When I started my research, I came across the name, I came across the Machloket, so I had the feeling, all right, who was he, who was he? I want you to know, he was an Adam Gadol. He was Reb Meir Simcha, the Arsa Meir, who we spoke about yesterday. He was the Arsa Meir's Chavruta in their youth. The Arsa Meir said to Reb Lezer Silva, when Reb Lezer Silva visited him, the Arsa Meir said, I don't understand what an America you have. My chaver, my chavruta, who's a giant of Torah, Rav Album, goes to America, and he's turned into a little person filled with machlokes, agonish, and nothing. What an America! It knocks the greatness out of great rabbanim. That was Rav Meir Simcha's comment. So Rav Album was a big Talmud Chacham. I have a special affection for him, because some of you know that I am a political right winger in the state of Israel. Right of center. Always argued with my wife. She would vote Kahana every election, and I told her, you're wasting your vote. I would vote Maftal, but this will be one of the few elections where we're both voting the same. A right winger? No. If you're a right winger and you want to aggravate yourself and cut your kishkas out, just go to Paris. Excuse me. Yes, Josh?
You voted Maftal and you were a right winger?
Yeah, I voted Maftal all the years because I'm a realist. I want to get the best I can a party that will have influence. Do what you want. I'm not telling you who to vote for. It's a democracy. After class, after class. listen to me carefully. I am a right winger. You want to get yourself aggravated? Friday, about 11 o'clock, go up to Kika Paris. The women in black are demonstrating against the occupation. I don't know. To me, the Arabs are occupying our land. I believe in what the Torah says. But to them, we are occupying their land. We're murderers. We're killers. They're demonstrating. No, most people ride by and laugh at them. Some people ride by and curse them, which doesn't help. But there used to be one Jew. Do you remember, with a little beard, with a big sign, would stand opposite them, Eretz Yisrael is ours, God gave it to us, we are not the occupiers, the Arabs are, the women in black are a disgrace to the blue and white of the Israeli flag. That gentleman's name was Tzvi Shimon Album. He was a great grandson of Rabbi Album. He's no longer alive. I loved him. I would see him every Friday demonstrating. I would see him Friday night at the Kotel. And boy, I used to tell him, Atama Chayeote. So I have a certain good feeling for Rabbi Albom. I don't want you to get the feeling he was in Eisfaf. But, my dear friends, money is money is money. You want to be like Rakefet and amount to nothing? Okay. But you got to be aware, you never let money influence you. My life, Baruch Hashem, my life is an open book, figuratively and literally. And I have never let money influence me. I've also never made a living, but that's secondary. Watch. You're giving hechsherim. You're getting money. You have a whole organization. The meat industry, Chicago, Al Capone, the mafia, what went on? They were heavily involved. Rabbi Albom was giving a heksher. I think he was reliable. There was, in today's money terminology, millions of dollars involved. There were vested interests. Rav, the Ritbaz, and I can tell you, I was at a funeral when in Jersey, one of the Eltura Rabbanim, Rabbi Weller, and I still remember his partner in Heksha eulogizing him, and I still remember the funeral, Rabbanim, all over, the mafia, wow, 1,000 people were there, 500 Jews, 500 Italians. You have to understand what went on. Sheiron, Rabbi Siegel of Jersey City, he lived to be 103, got up and he eulogized Rabbi Weller. I'll never forget this. Man can't get trying him with $1 million. You could trust him with $1 million. Total trustworthy. And I'm sitting there, a young rabbi, a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, a rabbi Maplewood, South Orange. $1 million. This is right, God. I hope at my funeral they'll say about me different things. But this is the reality. Man, can't them get trying with $1 million? Why be money involved? So the Ritbaz wanted to go into the shlachtais, the slaughterhouses, and check the knives. He wanted to see what's going on. The doors were closed to him. Whether Rabbi Albom closed the doors or the mafia closed the doors, it's never been researched to the end because there's simply no documents. But the Ritbaz got nowhere. And a tremendous machloket broke out. And Rabbi Albom actually wrote an entire sefer. It's all cited here. Sifrei Divrei Emet, one volume, two volumes, fighting with the Ritbaz, claiming that when the Ritbaz was here 3 years earlier, he made the famous statement that even the stones in America are treif. And now he came back and he wants to eat the cattle and eat the meat. The stones are no longer treif. And he justified the fact that the sheikhim refused to show their knives to anyone but the his mashgichim, because you can't have hefkarit in shrita. You can't have rabbanim knocking on the door every Monday and Thursday wanting to see the knives. We have authority, we have heksha, we have mashgichim, we have sheikhtim, and I give the heksha. And the fight was terrible. Chicago was split. The Ritbaz was hysterical. He could get nowhere. He could make no inroad. He could not get into the slaughterhouse. Within a year, he gave up, raised his hands, left Chicago, went to New York, and by 1905, gets on a boat and sails to Palestine. Now, here you have an unbelievable story. He came in 03. He ran to New York in the summer of 04. There is one story / anecdote that anyone researching the period has heard, told, and retold. I'll tell it to you as I heard it. Friday afternoon, the Ritbaz came to the slaughterhouse, wanted to see what was going on, and he got in. It was entrapment. Opened up the freezer where the slaughtered meat was. The door was closed behind him. The goal was he should asphyxiate and freeze to death. Finally, somehow, banging, yelling, shouting, someone had mercy on him, probably a Gentile. And Friday night, long after Shabbat began, they opened the door and with his last strength pulled himself together and crawled out. The anecdote continues that Shabbos morning with his family, he was on the platform and took the railroad that would ultimately take him to New York. Pikuach Nefesh, Deiche Shabbos. I've been asked 100 times over, is the story true? I've asked members of the family. I have to tell you, there's no way of proving what really happened. Just how do you research it today? There are no records. It was criminal activity. No one's alive from that period. My gut feeling is there must be truth to it. An anecdote like that could not have the credence it had even among his own family members. So it's an extremely sad but fascinating story. He will later have a son-in-law, one of the top Talmidim from Slutsk, one of the Yudalid Chazakah, Rav Yosef Chanvich, the Rav of Newark. If you don't recognize the name, make believe you do, so the ignorant will pass for the wise. Why should you recognize the name? Because Rav Yosef Chanvich had a very famous son, Professor Milton Chanvich of Cornell University. That was his son. And Professor Milton Chanvich was Yerush Shomer Shabbos. Rabbi Chanvich of Newark, famous name. Anyone who knows the history of the Agudas Rabbanim, he was president of the Agudas Rabbanim, great Mizrahi leader. That was the Ritbaz's son-in-law. The Chanvich family, quite a number of children, and that's my connection, if you're familiar with Washington, Rabbi Konvich's granddaughter knocks on the door of my sukkah in Maplewood, New Jersey in 1968, sent by the family to thank me for my postdoctoral research on her great-grandfather, the Ritbaz. And the rest of the story I've written about, I tell her off. Belongs to a Reconstructionist temple. And how can that be? Great-granddaughter of the Ritbaz, granddaughter of Rav Chanvich. And she starts to cry. And a friendship begins that lasts until today. As a matter of fact, on Sherry's desk is an email that has to be sent out for me to this family. But is it true? I can't be certain. But I have a gut instinct. It has to have a lot of truth to it. He ran to save his life. Go ahead.
In the book of letters to the Rav.
Yeah.
So there's a letter there that his response to Professor Konvich because he had asked about whether or not it was permitted if they were building a non-denominational chapel.
Right, right.
And so did he ask
At Cornell, right.
So he asked the Rav about whether it was permitted to put up stained glass windows.
Right.
The Rav said yes, as long as it had no
human figures. Right, right, right. And yet we learned Sanhedrin with the Rav, and the Rav raised the whole question of stained glass windows in a synagogue, a shayla b'chukotechem lo teilechu. Okay? So then someone asked the Rav, and he was thinking aloud. I don't think he was paskin la halacha. So someone shut out the Rav, Rebbe, the Lampert Auditorium, they use it to daven Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. There's stained glass there. So the Rav, with a sense of humor, shot back, saying, Minish gefrexen, zem das geboit. They didn't, ich hab gewen damals in Berlin. When they built the yeshiva, they didn't ask him, he was in Berlin. So he got away with not answering the question.
But this is one of the first questions in that book, in which the answer is yes.
And that's Professor Kunvich. Did you know he was a grandson of the Ridbaz?
No, I didn't know anything.
That's the connection. Milton to Rabbi Yosef to the Ridbaz. Now, in New York, it's very fascinating. He evidently had something to do with what today is Yeshiva University, because we find the letter of Haskama he gave to a sefer written by an American Rav. What does it mean? A Yudapeish Rebbe was an American Rebbe, Eliezer Drucker, who was Rav in many communities, Trenton, New York, and the letterhead is Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. So it seems that the Ridbaz, when he got to New York, had some interconnection with what today is Yeshiva University. Could be he taught there, could be they gave him office space, could be he was like his home to get to be able to disperse the last sets of the Yerushalmi he had with him. And in 1905, he went in Aliyah to Tzfat, and he becomes the Rav of Tzfat until his death 8 years later on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, 1913, practically 100 years ago. You will all recall his being in Tzfat because he was the great Baal Machloket with Rav Kook on the Het HaMechira. When now already by the 1910s, the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael was big and the Het HaMechira was widely debated, and of course Rav Kook was the big proponent of the Het HaMechira, and the Ridbaz was 100% opposed. When you look at Haggai Ben Arzi's doctorate at Bar Ilan, which was published afterwards, I believe by Yediot, and I will come to it in the Sunday class, a very fascinating doctorate on Rav Kook as a posek on the Eretz Yisrael scene. You know who Haggai Ben Arzi is, right? It's the Prime Minister's, it's brother-in-law, it's Sarah Netanyahu's kid brother. And it's a very, I've told you, the Ben Arzi family is a very fascinating family, because the father who died a few years ago, close to 100, was the last living Talmud of the Altar of Novadik, of Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz of Novadik, the last living Talmud. And he gave it up, I told you, for the dream, Eretz Yisrael's, socialism, Zionism, and religion had nothing to do with it. And his eldest son, professor at Hebrew U, I don't even want to use the words he used about the Jewish children in Hebron, and his son, that means the grandson of Ben Arzi, of Sarah Netanya's father, Sarah's nephew, refused to serve in the army and went to jail. And the grandfather got up in public and said, it was quoted in every Israeli newspaper, dealing about 30 years ago, got up and said, this is the saddest day of my life that my grandson does not want to serve in the IDF. And he said, the greatest mistake I made was living religion, leaving Torah, and he came back, b'lev v'nefesh, total Shomer Torah mitzvah, he and his wife. So it's interesting that his younger son, Sarah, you would call Masoratit, is traditional. And the younger boy is total, a Torah Jew, B'lev V'nefesh. So he writes about the machloket between the Ritbaz. There's an entire chapter and Rav Kook. I'll quote the book dealing with what Yitzchak asked yesterday about, can you be samech on a dat yachid, b'shat ha-dachak? So it's an interesting thesis where he shows, or attempts to show at least, I don't know if I entirely agree with him, but that's not important now. His thesis is that when it came to Eretz Yisrael Shilas, that Rav Kook went out of his way, l'smoch al dat yechidim, when it helped the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. And part of this analysis deals with the Ritbaz and Rav Kook and the Machloiket on Shemitah. Now, let me just go one step further. Very, very fascinating. One of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim we had in the 20th century, and a man who was universally admired, even by what we call today, to use the word, a word that didn't exist then, by the Haredi world, in addition to the Tzioni Dati world, was Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Reb Herzog, as you know, was considered the greatest Baki in the state of Israel, in Palestine. His knowledge was indescribable. He spoke something like 9 different languages fluently. So you'll, and Rav Herzog, that which we was published, everything was published posthumously, because unfortunately his life was totally lost in the service of the Jewish people. If you look at pictures when he was elected chief rabbi in 1937, you see a young man with a black beard. He was chief rabbi of Ireland, and he's now elected chief rabbi of the state of Israel, and you look at pictures of him 8 years later, 1945, 1946, you see an old man with a totally white beard. And what happened? In 8 years, he went from youth to such old age. What happened to him? The Holocaust. He had all that responsibility, the founding of Israel, the shilas that he had to deal with, the children he had to pull out of the monasteries, the famous stories of his going in and saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What a story. And he aged. No, can anyone tell me, where did he study? Who was his Rebbe? He never studied in any yeshiva. He was raised in Paris. Right or wrong, his father was the Rav of what later becomes, I believe, the Rabbi Monk Shul in Paris, what they called the Eidah Haredit in Paris. It's not such an Eidah Haredit, but it was a Frum Shul in Paris. Father was the Rav. Kid grew up. Then he spent many years in England, has a PhD, English, England, in marine biology, wrote on Tchelet. He's a scientist. His knowledge was unbelievable. No, he was taught by his father. Then he was autodidactic. He did it all on his own. He had one Rebbe. Where did I say the Ritbaz visited when he was selling his Yerushalmi? What was the first city I mentioned? Paris. When he visited Paris, this little kid was, I don't know, 11, 12. He latched himself onto the Ritbaz. The Ritbaz loved him. They corresponded. His only Rebbe and Rebbe Mavak was the Ritbaz. But the story doesn't end there. Rosh Hashanah, 1913. Rav Herzog, who already was a Rav, recognized, had a terrible dream that a Sefer Torah is being burned in Tzfat. And Motzai Rosh Hashanah, he gets a telegram from the Ritbaz's family that the Ritbaz died. And it turned out at the very moment he had that dream, the Ritbaz died. That's a very fascinating point in the interconnection. The Ritbaz and Rav Herzog, chief rabbinate of Israel, these were great Jews, Mizrachiites, but beloved and honored by the entire Torah world. Rav Herzog used to give a shiur on Friday that all the Gedolim in Yerushalayim, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach went to the shiur, Rav Shlomo Yosef Elyoshev went to the shiur. This was Rav Herzog. It was a different era. In a certain degree, a better era. There was Kavod HaTorah, love of Torah. It didn't matter what the outer personage looked like, but people could see through. And this was the Ritbaz, this was Rav Herzog. Okay. Yes, Yoni.
How did he end up in Stock? Who brought him to Stock?
Oh, because they were looking for a Litvish Rav in Svat. That's why. There was a rabbinate open in Svat. And he was unanimously elected. The Ritbaz was a tremendous Shein Dover. You follow? So when he went to Tzfat, he was known as the Tzfat Rav. That's the title that everyone knows him by until today. You have to be a historian to know about Slutz, to know about Kletz, to know about everything that went on before. But he was Tzfat Rav. And his family later, the Werner family, they're all descendants. They were Rabbanim in Tzfat, they're Rabbanim today in Tiberias. The Werner family interconnects. The Finkel family interconnects with the Ritbaz. They're machatonim. You follow? There's intermarriage there between those families. And I believe the Orbach family, there's the Ritbaz, left a tremendous family. But the part that's in Israel is essentially from the part that's in America. You have to look with candles to find a Brekele Yiddishkeit. Maybe you should know, Chabad plays a role with the one family that Baruch Hashem is Shomer Torah Mitzvah today. Rakefet gets a little credit, and Chabad gets a little credit, okay? Chabad opened in Cherry Hill, and Chabad is Chabad, but you have no idea what has happened to the Ritbaz, to descendants, Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. But this is America, this is assimilation. We spoke about it yesterday. Rabbi Akiva, you listen, you don't have to go any further than Rabbi Akiva, and who remained Jewish, and it's just an amazing thing what I said, the grandson whom they sat Shiva for, because he became a Hasidic Rebbe, that's the only Eger. If you meet Egers, and I taught Egers, they're all descended from him, not from any other sons of Rabbi Akiva. It's all from that grandson whose father was the son of Rabbi Akiva Eger, and the son sat Shiva, because the grandson became a Chassidic Rebbe, became a Chassid. It's beyond words. Gentlemen, we have arrived. Until now, we have seen absolute failure. No matter what the intentions were, no matter what the plans were, no matter what the dream was, whether it was RJJ, whether it was the Ritbaz, New York, Chicago, couldn't get off the floor. The Ritbaz benefited from having visited RJJ in 1900, having met him on his, what ultimately becomes his deathbed 2 years later. And he benefited from that. Why? Because he was very intelligent, the Ritbaz, very smart, very sharp. And he evidently made up his mind that I'm not going to let it happen to me. And the minute he saw what was going on in Chicago and he couldn't get into the Schlachtleis, he couldn't have peace of mind, he couldn't supervise properly, he picked up, went on to New York. And from New York, he went on to Israel, where he had 8 very productive years, an entire new life. And I mean, until today, if not for his machlokes with Rav Kook, no one would know about the Ritbaz. Today, in the state of Israel, hundreds of thousands know about the Ritbaz, because he had come to Tzfat, and he was involved in the Yishuv, And he had a machlokes with Rav Kook. And that machlokes, as you're going to see in a year from now, is going to go on once more, and it's going to go on with dirt and filth and anguish and aggravation. And this is what, can I tell you, when we Jews start fighting, I'll tell you a good vot. What does Pirkei Avos say? Kol machlokes shehi l'shem shamayim kayemet. That if a machlokes is l'shem shamayim, some good comes out of it. So I once heard a Baal Musa say, fabulous vot, the Yetzirah, Retzach HaRayin, as the Machlokes is L'Shem Shamayim, when the Yetzirah convinces you that the Machlokes is L'Shem Shamayim, it goes on and on and on. You never can stop the Machlokes. And all right, we have a tremendous Machlokes, L'Shem Shamayim, Shemitah, Heter Shemitah. Can you sell the land? Can't you sell the land? Is there an Ish of Lotichanim? Is there Shemitah at all, Bisman Hazeh? Shemitah Aminag? Is it the Rabbanon? What about Shemitah today with 6 million Jews in Israel? It's a based in? Can you be Samachanoid based in? Can you eat Arab produce? Is there a problem with dysentery with Arab produce? You don't know what goes on in a Shemitah year. How many more beds Shaarei Tzedek needs for people who come down with dysentery? And these are real issues that unfortunately have been with us now for over 120 years. This issue does not go away, and you're going to see it, unfortunately, very loud and clearly in a year and a half's time. Now, this did not work. But there was another problem, a tremendous problem. What shaped a kid's life? You go to school. You go to school. Look at your own children. What's the greatest influence in your life? Where do you spend today? Where do you spend your first 18, 20 years? Some of us, 24 years. I don't know how many years I went to school. Tremendous influence. By the 1880s, there are all types of laws in the various states in the United States that a kid has to have an education. You can go back and do the research. It wasn't like today. Today, every kid has to go to high school, has to be in school till he's 18 years of age, I believe, unless he graduates high school earlier. Could be at 17 years. But in those days, elementary school, certainly in New York City, was a must. Kids worked at 14, 15, but an elementary school education they needed. Now, look at the atmosphere. Who were the teachers? Generally Irish ladies, some Italians. These were people who had come. Many were born in the States. Many were acculturated. And look at the message the youngster is getting. This is America. This is tomorrow. This is success. This is the way I will earn a living. The public school, the influence was overwhelming. And it had to be that way. The kid came home. He loved his mother. He loved his father. We're talking about good kids. But your parents were greenhorns. They didn't speak the language of the land. Or as Solomon Schechter said, they didn't know baseball. There's a famous quote from Professor Solomon Schechter, the man who founded conservative Judaism, turned JTS and started the turn into, started, because when he died, 1915, I believe it is, it was still not a conservative institution as we know it. But he made the initial compromises. But he said, one time at a graduation, it's documented, that if you don't know baseball, you can't be a good rabbi in the United States. No, go and tell Solomon Schechter that 100 years later, Rosh Kollel would be signed in to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Chicago. You've come a long way, Solomon Schechter. Your insights were absolutely correct. But you understand, this divide, this fence. Not only that, all right, so you love your parents. You go to shul. Well, what happened in shul? What did the kids say? How could he relate? The Rav was in the eternal world of Torah. The Rav didn't speak a word of English. The Rav didn't want his wife Americanized. The Rebbetzins Americanized. They had to go shopping. They had to deal with the fishmonger. They had to deal with the butcher. They had to deal with the fruit and vegetable people. So many of them had to deal with non-Jews at times. They learned a little English. They understood a little bit about America. But the Rav, he was in the same world that he had left behind 90% of the time. No difference from Vilna, Minsk, Riga, or the Lower East Side of New York from the Rav's point of view, from his Weltanschauung. So the kid went to shul. The Rav preached. What did the kid understand? What can influence the kid? Even if the kid knew Yiddish, and these kids all knew Yiddish, of course. They grew up. Their parents spoke Yiddish. So the kids picked up Yiddish. My parents both knew Yiddish very well. They were born in Harlem, but their parents spoke Yiddish. I don't, to each other, of course. My Zaydim Baba Mitzad, my father, certainly spoke only Yiddish. And my other grandparents, their native language was Yiddish, although they already spoke a little English. That's not yet the environment in the shul. And I want to end off the class with something we spoke about, but I want to put it into context once again. A word that you didn't even know what it meant, a spittoon, a cuspidor. What do you think a kid sees? If you look today on the websites of the anti-Orthodox, the hatred, no, mitzitza bepeh. I don't really use the term they use in English to describe it. No, if anyone sees that term, you get sick. It turns you off immediately. Well, a kid comes into the shul and he sees the balabatim, the famous balabatim, the men who own this store and that store. Mindavin, they walk to the back of the shul and into the spittoon. And you couldn't take it away. This was part of their mentality. You know what? We spoke about Rabbi Joseph Luchstein yesterday. Joseph H. Luchstein used to regale audiences telling the stories of the fights he had to remove the spittoons from KJ, from Kehillat Jeshurun, the most elegant Orthodox synagogue outside in the world today. Most elegant. I don't, all right, the great synagogue certainly overtakes it in elegance. But outside of the great synagogue, where do you have a shul like Kehillat Jeshurun? And there were spittoons. No. And Rabbi Luchstein would say that, like, Rabbi, we had spittoons in Europe, we had spittoons in the Lower East Side. No one's going to take away the right from us to use the spittoon in davening. You see, the kids walked into the shul. You can be the nicest kid in the world. You can be a kid with them, with Yirat Shemayim. Most children have ingrained, we have a soul, we seek God. We seek God. A kid is a believer. He can be the finest kid in the world. I'm quoting the Sfarno, I'm quoting the Zohar. Everyone has from God's neshama in him. Look into Pashat Bereishit. But the kid is turned off. It's a different world. He's going to public school. And imagine if you would say to a teacher in public school, why can't we have a spittoon in back of the class? They'd laugh you out. What? This is America. It's the year 1880. We're modern. We're not primitive. And with all the best of intentions, good parents, good rabbis, nice shuls, the kid was more influenced by what was outside his religious sphere than that which was inside. And this was the tremendous challenge. And with all the heartache of RJJ, these very same Jews on the Lower East Side came up with a solution. Eitz Chaim, yeshiva, or day school, call it what you wish, 1886. How does the Chinese proverb go? Let me end off with it. A journey of but 1,000 miles begins with a single step. One little step. A little handful of children. And it changed the entire history of the Torah people. Here we are, a group of adults, learned adults, capable adults, successful adults, sitting in the center of the world, in the holy city of Jerusalem, learning Torah, Musa, Hashkafa, and all that goes with it. Sitting in this room, some of us are fathers of tens and tens of children when you put it together. Scores of grandchildren. Some are on my level, working on the great-grandchildren. I already have a great-grandson makes brachot. Have a great-granddaughter who's very bright. She's going to be making brachas by the time of her first birthday, as I see it. And I have another great-grandchild on the way, can I inherit? And it all goes back to one little step, Ellie, on the Lower East Side in 1886. And next week, you will be there. Let me review. That's a good share today. We did okay. Yitzchak, you can take a shower, cold shower on Shabbos if you have to. Thank Danny. The source is here. You take it later. Reb Moshe, look at it. It's a big shiva afterwards. I just xeroxed the start. You'll find he's dealing with his grandson-in-law, Reb Shabtai Rappaport, who's a little bit surprised at Reb Moshe. I want to ask you, were these questions answered, Danny? Very fascinating. Your first question, holding hands with your wives in public, you know who discusses it? Did they tell you or no one mentioned it? Reb Yehuda Herzl Henkin, in Shulet and Shulet B'nai Banim, I think it's volume 3. I'm willing to discuss some of these questions, but I told you what I want you to do. After the election, I'll give a Hashkafa class, because we'll see what's going on here, so let's come in. What did we do today? We finished the Red Baz. Did he travel on Shabbos or didn't he? I leave it to your imagination. What would you do if Friday night they tried to kill you? Would you run out on Shabbos, pikuach nefesh? I can tell you halachically, you can build a good case, pikuach nefesh. Take my word, Fred. Then we just said a few words, laying the groundwork for Eitz Chaim, and Be'ezrat Hashem Sunday, wouldn't miss it for anything, when you find the manuscript. How does that change the halachic situation? Gentlemen, let us roll with the freebies. First of all, we have Yoni Chabad speaks to you. Yeah, okay, so three freebies that deal with Chabad. I'm quoted in one, there's an article here, and you'll see on page 2, Rabbi Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf is quoted and quoted correctly. You have here the Shazar. They're going to have a weekend on Shazar, not a weekend, a three-day conference on his relationship. Let me just see. No, this is the one. All right, this is all Chabad. This is the one on the Alter Rebbe, and then there's the third thing. Place this back to Yoni. Okay. Danny, this is with your yichus, everything about Rabbi Dr. David Hartman's last two books. And I want to tell you, it shakes me to my inner core, because there's a whole cadre around him and they think that is modern Orthodox. If that is modern Orthodox, I am a Haredi to the second power. Okay? But I think I am modern Orthodox. Then we have a real problem. Gentlemen, this is what I offered last night, and there were no takers. Remember I mentioned the big machlokes for Baron Cutler and the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I mentioned this many times over the last 54 years, on Shor Shenagach Et HaPara, if you're allowed to learn Pshat, Yetzer Hara, being knocked around by the Yetzer Hara. This is a scholarly article on what the machlokes really was, and when all is said and done, I still stand on the version as I heard it in Lakewood. And here is a fabulous story of a mikveh that went dry in Omaha, Nebraska, in the middle of the summer, and how they remade the mikveh by bringing in a ton of dry ice. Fabulous picture here of the ice in the mikveh. How they did it, very fascinating. If anyone wants, again, four more copies of this booklet, In Memory of My Mother. It's written by my nephew, Meimat HaIsha Al Pi Yahadut, Biruah Ma'amik B'Mamat HaIsha V'Ha'ish B'Chevra HaMerdenit V'Havanat HaInstikratia. What word is that? It's a transliteration here, which I don't understand. Shebeinehem. Finally, I want to mention that Rabbi Steve Przanski, in a lecture he just gave, Interaction, thank you, in a lecture he just gave December 26, 2012, gave a lecture on Civil War and immigration to America, and he quotes what I said in class at 14:30 in the lecture about the Civil War making America real for East European Jews. My Talmud, Rabbi Steve Przanski, in a lecture that he gave in Teaneck. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Verdanya. Okay. Sam, how are you coming along?
Yes, you're welcome.